Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
This is Basketball History 101 with Rick Loaiza.
Welcome back to award-winning Basketball History 101, part of the Sports History Network. I am your host, Rick Loaiza, and this is a podcast where we bring to life some of the forgotten stories from basketball history. We are bringing old-school basketball to a new-school audience. And today, we bring you the third entry into the Lost NBA Teams series. In this occasional series, we are covering those teams that have played in the NBA but no longer exist. In all, 15 teams have played in the NBA and then went out of business. Then, of course, there are the current 30 teams that still play in the NBA, and that makes a grand total of 45 different teams that have played in the NBA for at least one season. Back in part one of the series, we covered the Washington Capitals, originally coached by Red Auerbach. We also covered the Providence Steamrollers and the Toronto Huskies, the host of the very first NBA game ever. In part two, we covered the Chicago Stags, the St. Louis Bombers, and the Cleveland Rebels, three Midwestern teams that had every intention of making a go of professional basketball, but who all disappeared within a few years of the start of the NBA. Today, in part three of our series, we start with the Detroit Falcons. They only played a single season in the NBA before disappearing. But even though their life in the NBA was short-lived, there is a lot to unpack. The team went through two head coaches that year. And by the way, that is not good for a brand new team to be changing coaches mid-season. But their first coach was a man named Glenn Curtis. He was born in 1894 and was already 52 years old when he accepted the coaching job with the Falcons. But he was in extremely ill health. According to player Tom King, Coach Curtis looked wasted, like he had cancer. What nobody knew at the time was cancer is exactly what he had. He just hadn't told anybody, and it completely zapped him of his strength. For practice, he would do no instruction, as that took too much effort. Coach Curtis would simply tell the players to scrimmage, and then he would sit on the sidelines and watch. He based his tryouts on what the players did during the scrimmage, and the players that had skill and worked well together would make the team. Any selfish players would get cut. So why would the Falcons even hire Curtis in the first place? Well, he had quite a resume. As a high school coach, he won the Indiana State Championship four times, and that is a huge deal. He also coached at Indiana State University and had a good level of success there. So, when the Falcons were putting their team together for that very first season of the NBA, they felt that Curtis was the perfect man for the job. They just did not know the level of his actual health. But there is another tidbit of information for you. Glenn Curtis was John Wooden's high school coach when they won the Indiana State Championship in 1927 with Martinsville High School. Now, the Falcons did not get things going on a good foot. They lost their very first game by a score of 50-33 to the Washington Capitals, and the team started out the season with a record of 12-22 in their first 34 games, and that is when Curtis resigned. The travel of professional sports was just too much for him. His health would not allow him to continue. Also, his practices, as I mentioned before, were nothing more than scrimmage. There was no instruction, no sense of offensive or defensive systems. The Falcons approached the season like it was a series of pickup games, and there was also a lack of leadership from the top. Now, I have always believed that the really good teams, like the ones that win championships, have great leadership coming from the top. The Falcons did not have that. Their primary owner, Arthur Wirtz, owned several other sports teams, and the Falcons were at the bottom of his priority list. The Falcons had the lowest average attendance of any team in the NBA. They averaged just over 1,200 fans per game. Now, that will not get it done in the days before merchandise sales and television revenue. The primary source of income was ticket sales, and the Falcons did not have enough of them. They lost $120,000 during that first year, and the owners had had enough. They pulled the plug and did not return in 1947 when the NBA was preparing for their second season. Now, this is a good place to take a break, and I'll be right back with more on the defunct teams of the NBA.
Thank you.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about sports yesteryear, and so we're so pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings your sports history to life anywhere. The Row One Gallery includes over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, and more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. And any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. And in Row One Shop, check out the thousands more of unique items with the retro and historical designs dating back to 1876, including t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, phone cases, mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com, ROW number one, for access to the full Row One catalog and for gallery prints and gift items. Plus, get a 15% discount off all prints on the Row One Pictorum Gallery with coupon code SHN15. Follow the link on the show notes.
Hello, sports history fans. I'm Ross from the podcast Pigskin Tales. You're about to jump into another thrilling sports history moment, but first, let's dive into today's sponsor, just in time for the holiday season. Introducing Art of Words, the brainchild of word artist Dan Duffy from Philadelphia. Dan meticulously crafts stunning images by handwriting relevant words from some of the greatest sports moments in time. These unique budget-friendly illustrations are the perfect gift, sparking cherished memories and capturing hearts. Choose from city skylines, sports, history, and musicians to find a piece for everyone. And here's the exciting part. For that sports fanatic in your life, gift them a piece of their favorite team or player's history. Art of Words tells a compelling story. Explore collegiate stadiums, each meticulously crafted with every football victory etched into words. Or venture into baseball stadiums, handwritten with every player from the team's illustrious history. My favorite on the site is Bryce Harper 2021 MVP year. Because I'm a big stats guy, I think that's one of the coolest things ever. Check it out. Don't wait. Order a print today for yourself and your loved one this holiday season. Transform your wall into a gallery of captivating art and surprise your family and friends with a print of their own. Use code SHN15 at artofwords.com for a 15% discount on your order in November and December. Visit Art of Words, where words magically transform into stunning art, evoking cherished memories and touching the hearts of those who you care about. Again, use the code SHN15 for 15% off at artofwords.com.
Welcome back to the show, and let us continue with the stories of the teams that once played in the NBA but no longer exist. Next is the Pittsburgh Ironmen. Now, just like the Detroit Falcons, the Ironmen only played one season in the NBA before going out of business. Their record was particularly horrible. They only won 15 games in a 60-game season. Their coach, Paul Birch, was a legendary player back in the 1920s. He was a star from Duquesne University and then played with the original Celtics barnstorming team. Now, if you played for the original Celtics, then you had to be good, because that version of the Celtics only kept six players. They kept five starters and one substitute. Now, before I keep going, I want to be clear that the original Celtics from the 1920s and 1930s are a completely separate team from the Boston Celtics. They are two different organizations that just happen to have the same name. Anyway, Birch always liked to tell anyone who would listen that he had once played for the original Celtics, because that was a prestigious team to play for. It was like saying you played for the Showtime Lakers or the Michael Jordan Bulls. But the Ironmen had trouble recruiting players because everyone knew back in the 1940s that baseball and football were the two most popular sports in Pittsburgh, and they might have trouble drawing fan base. The players were not wrong. However, they did attract one older player who came from the nearby city of Aliquippa and saw the Ironmen as a chance to play near his hometown. That player was Press Maravich, the father of Pistol Pete Maravich. The older Maravich was already 31 years old, which was ancient by the standards of 1946, and he averaged 5 points per game for his effort. Now, the Ironmen were as dysfunctional as they come. Coach Birch was one of those coaches who alienated his player. Near the end of the season, Press Maravich had had enough of Birch and screamed at him that he was ready to fight right there. And Maravich was serious. He was ready to get into a fist fight with his own coach. Now, here is one last story of how poorly the season went for the Ironmen. Now, this happened in a December game against the Philadelphia Warriors. It was the middle of the third quarter when Art Hillhouse from Philadelphia was fouled and awarded 2 free throws. He made the first one, but he missed the second one. However, the official scorekeeper, Ray Downey, had credited Hillhouse with making both of those free throws. Now, keep in mind that Downey worked for the Ironmen. He had just given the opposing team an extra free throw that they did not make. In the end, the game came down to the last few minutes. The Ironmen were fouling on purpose in hopes that the Warriors would miss their free throws and give the Ironmen a chance to score. Now, this is a similar strategy to what teams do today when they are down a couple of points near the end of the game. Now, because of that extra free throw that the Warriors received, the Ironmen thought that they were down by 2 instead of being down by only 1 in the final minute. Now, that mistake by the scorekeeper directly impacted the Ironmen's endgame strategy. The losing team will employ a very different strategy when down by 2 as opposed to being down by only 1. In any case, the Warriors won the game 62-60, and the Ironmen filed an official protest with Commissioner Maurice Potaloff. The commissioner saw the merit in the protest, but because the scorekeeper worked for the Ironmen, the entire fiasco was deemed as their own fault. Basically, the Ironmen were told that they should have hired a better scorekeeper. In the end, the Ironmen only averaged 1,300 fans per game and lost $200,000 of the season. The owners just shut the whole team down right there and did not return for a second season. Press Maravich decided to end his playing career and go into coaching. Now, he would have played another season if the team had stuck around, but he did not want to keep playing and moving his family all over the place. Our final team for today is the Indianapolis Jets. They joined the NBA for the league's third season in 1948, but they only stuck around for one season and then went out of business. They had a horrible season, going 18-42 and going through 2 head coaches during their one season. This is about as bad as it gets, but if you have been listening to the series, then you know that this is not uncommon for a new league and a new team to be trying to gain traction and put a good product on the court. Now, I love basketball as much as anybody here, but even I know that the NBA is a business, and the best thing for business is to have a winning team on the court. Winning teams sell tickets. They also sell jerseys, hats, you name it. Winning teams make money. For the Jets, they decided to save money by having one of their players do double duty as the head coach. And for that role, they picked Bruce Hale. Now, the reason I am familiar with the name is that Hale went to Santa Clara University in the San Francisco Bay Area, which happens to be my alma mater. Go Broncos. Now, Hale was also the team's second leading scorer with just under 13 points per game, but unfortunately, Hale could not lead the team to that many victories. After the first 17 games, the team was 4-13. Hale was fired as a coach, but kept on as a player because he was one of the top scorers on the team. But the team was constantly in flux that season. The NBA only kept 10 players per team back then, but the Jets went through 24 different players that season as players were cut and new players were signed. It was like they had a revolving door in the locker room. There was just no way to get any real team chemistry among the players when they were constantly changing. After finishing the season in last place in the Western Division, the team decided to fold and go out of business. As for Hale, he played for a couple of more teams before becoming a head coach at the University of Miami, and there Bruce Hale would land the biggest recruit of his entire coaching career. He landed future Hall of Famer Rick Barry. Now, Barry eventually married Hale's daughter, so Hale became Rick Barry's father-in-law. Now, that is a lot of athletic genes in one family, as Hale is also the grandfather of 3 NBA players, John Barry, Brent Barry, and Drew Barry. But that was it for the Jets, as it seems that they were just a blip in the annals of the NBA. So that does it for this entry of the Lost Teams of the NBA. Join us next time when we share the story of Elgin Baylor's retirement and why his timing could not have been any worse. That's next time on Basketball History 101, part of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of Sports Yesteryear. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com to find out more about this and other sports history podcasts. If you like what you hear, please hit that subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts. And check out our page on Facebook. It's called Basketball History 101 Podcast. There you will find shorter historical posts as well as comments and discussion starters on today's game. I'll also announce there when new episodes come out. I want to thank my producer and editor, Jacob Loiza. Join us each week as we continue to mine the history of basketball for more great stories from the past. Take care and see you soon.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
This is Mark Mortier, and if you're a sports history fan like me, tune in and hear me talk about some great sports moments of the past. Growing up during the 1970s, I got to watch some of the most iconic moments in sports history. Hank Aaron breaking Babe Ruth's home run record. Willis Reed limping out of the locker room in Game 7 of the NBA Finals at Madison Square Garden as the fans erupted with a thunderous ovation. The 1980 Miracle on Ice, as Team USA defeated the powerful Soviet Union in the Olympics. Listen every Tuesday on Yesterday Sports.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.